Good morning, you may be seated. The first case on our calendar, 03-233, Chrysler Financial Company versus Thomas Zeno. Tax Commissioner, Mr. Otero.
I'm David Otero on behalf of Daimler Chrysler Services North America. We are the appellant and we're the claimant in the underlying tax case. This is a case of statutory interpretation, and the principal issue in this appeal is whether Chrysler qualifies as a vendor under Ohio Revenue Code 5739.121. I'm going to refer to as the Ohio bad debt statute. And the meaning of vendor under the Ohio bad debt statute is what determines this appeal. This is an issue of first impression under Ohio law and is the subject of the BTA's underlying opinion. The BTA entirely concentrated on this issue of whether Chrysler is a vendor. If Chrysler is a vendor, then it's eligible for a sales tax refund in this case. The BTA decided in a 2-to-1 decision that Chrysler was not a vendor and thus denied Chrysler's claim. There's no cross appeal here. We are not contesting the BTA's factual findings. Instead, we're just contesting the legal conclusion that flows from the BTA's findings of fact. Therefore, the court should ignore any attempts by the commissioner to try to relitigate any of these facts because they're not at issue.
Counsel, on the subject of whether or not Chrysler is a vendor, in terms of the tax and in terms of any refunds, is this transaction by transaction? In other words, can Chrysler not be a vendor in certain transactions and be a vendor in others? Or is it once a vendor or always a vendor?
Well, Chrysler is a vendor in Ohio, and that was found by the BTA that it sells.
In terms of lease cars and?
And leases. And it does also have sales. And Chrysler didn't make these particular sales.
Right.
In connection with each of the transactions that are the subject of this particular claim, Chrysler was a vendor, is a vendor both in its own right, that it is a vendor, always is a vendor, and also it was an assignee in each of these cases of the car dealers who were the people who made the sales in each of these instances. Chrysler's a vendor both statutorily because the, first of all, it is a vendor, and secondly, in connection with each of these transactions, it's a vendor because the definition of vendor says that a vendor is a person, and a person includes assignees. So under the statute, Chrysler was a vendor in connection with each of these particular sales. And also as a matter of common law in Ohio, all the rights of the vendors that made the sale, the car dealers, flow to Chrysler as its assignee, and Chrysler stands in the shoes of the vendor. So Chrysler is a vendor in general, in the general sense, and also in connection with each of the particular transactions at issue. The basic factual background is, I'll be very brief about it. Oh, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, by the way. I apologize for not mentioning that up front. But Ohio car dealers sold each of the cars to consumers in each of these transactions pursuant to installment sales contracts. And each of these contracts was financed. Part of what was financed was the sales tax, because the sales tax on a financing transaction, even though all the payments are collected over time, all the sales tax is due up front. So when you buy your car for $20,000, even though you might only pay $1,000, you pay sales tax on the whole $20,000.
What about transactions in which the buyer pays some money down? Is all of that money by operation of law. Is the first money the tax money and therefore is not financed?
No, the money is applied pro rata. Just so if you had a $20,000.
Well, I realize the dealer may regard it that way or Chrysler may regard it that way, but is there any law established in terms of the state of Ohio's tax code that would indicate the first money is tax money?
No, there is not. There's no authority that would support that proposition. I'm not aware of any authority nationwide either that would support that particular proposition. I mean, the way that the cash flows is that the contract is written and then the contract is presented to Chrysler. And the dealer knows ahead of time that Chrysler is going to accept the contract because the dealer knows the criteria that Chrysler has for financing. And then Chrysler writes a check for the entire amount that's financed to the dealer. And then the dealer takes that check, which includes the sales tax, and the dealer holds that money as the paid remittance agent of the state and then turns over the sales tax to the state. So as far as the state is concerned, they've received the entire sales tax, and Chrysler has stepped into the shoes of the dealer and has advanced that sales tax to the customer. And the bad debt statute provides that if the customer doesn't pay that money back, in other words, that the sale doesn't happen for the price that the people expected, that after application of any proceeds, after collection efforts, that Chrysler is then entitled to get a refund of any sales tax it doesn't pay back. The reason that bad debt statute is in place and provides for that is to remedy the injustice that happens when the states charge sales tax on an expected sales price, let's say $20,000, and it turns out that the sale is only $10,000. For example, if the sales price was $20,000, the sales tax is charged on the $20,000, the customer only pays $5,000, there's a repossession of the car, there's a sale of the car, and then there's still a $20,000 debt. That sale really didn't turn out to be a $20,000 sale. It only turned out to be a $10,000 sale.
But that bad debt is to the vendor.
That bad debt is actually to Chrysler as the vendor, because the...
Wasn't that the issue, who the vendor is?
Right. Chrysler is the one that's out the money, because the vendor got paid in full at the very beginning of the transaction. And Chrysler steps into the shoes of the vendor, takes an assignment of their rights in the same way that
No question the dealer would be able to take that if Chrysler wasn't in the picture, correct?
Exactly. There's absolutely
And hasn't the dealer assigned its right, title, and interest to Chrysler?
Exactly. Chrysler steps into their shoes. If Chrysler doesn't get the refund, nobody gets the refund because the dealer...
Well, how many times is that bad debt credit issued? It's only issued either to the dealer or to Chrysler.
That's correct. There's only one refund to be had, and if Chrysler doesn't get it, nobody gets it, and the state overcollects tax. Because in my example on the $20,000, the state's collected sales tax on a $20,000 sale that only turned out to be a $10,000 sale, and then there's no remedy if Chrysler can't get that refund.
Counselor, does this happen in other situations other than Chrysler? Or do other car manufacturers find themselves in the same situation as Chrysler with the same financing scheme and then the bad debt to which they assume and then the state pocketing the tax?
Yes, I mean, this is the way that generally that auto financing works in the marketplace today. Very few dealers hold on to their own paper. They can't afford to do business that way. So they sign up the contract knowing that they're going to assign the contract to a third party. Chrysler Finance or Ford Motor Credit or the banks, they're okay, all in
well,
the same
you
situation.
You said or the banks. As I'm listening to your argument unfold, does this same, it would seem that if Bank One, for example, the dealer sent you over to Bank One, or is it different if they sell the paper to Bank One?
Well, it's
in terms of this refund, if the customer just said Bank One's my bank and that's where I'm financing my car, and then they don't pay, you would have the same over collection of tax. But does Bank One have the ability to get this deduction from future taxes?
That's a very interesting question, because the policy reasons are still there for Bank One to collect. And usually a bank does business the same way that I just described. Usually they do business with the finance company rather than the customer directly. But you do see in the credit union area that customers sometimes line up a loan ahead of time, and that's direct financing as opposed to what I'm describing, which is
sure.
Indirect. The policy concerns are the same, but Bank One, in your example, has a more difficult argument than Chrysler has, because it can't make the argument that it took assignment of the rights from the selling dealer. So if Bank One is a vendor in general, Bank One has the first level of argument we make, that the statute doesn't say that you have to be the vendor that made the sale. You just have to be a vendor.
But if the dealer had an arrangement with his local bank, and some dealers do, don't they? I mean, there's to steer the business to a certain bank, and the dealer gets a little piece of that action, and the bank gets the business. So the dealer takes care of the transaction and then assigns it off just as they've assigned it to Chrysler. Wouldn't they be in the same shoes in terms of the argument you're advancing?
As long as the financing institution took by assignment from the car dealer, whether it's Chrysler or Bank One or whatever, they'd be in exactly the same situation.
So your client isn't in a unique position because they manufactured the auto.
No, and
their position is simply by virtue of the assignment from the original vendor.
That's correct, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, I'm referring to the client as Chrysler, but Chrysler Manufacturing is not the claimant. It's Chrysler Financing, which is, you know, a related
entity. So they could conceivably be financing Hondas even.
And they do. Not many, but they finance a few. If in this particular claim there is some financing of other automobiles, but they're primarily Chrysler products. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if that's acceptable, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Otero.
Thank you.
Ms. Katz.
May it please the court. Justices, you are correct. This is the first of many financial institutions coming to the Board of Tax Appeals and then to this court, looking for refunds under the statute. Should this court find them eligible and find that they have standing as vendors to apply for a refund under the bad debt statute? For this reason, the Board of Tax Appeals correctly found that they were not vendors. They did not take all of the obligations of a vendor to remit the sales tax to the state to collect a sales tax. And in this particular case, as a dealer, they were not getting title from the automobile for the customer. The vendor then sold the contracts for full price, so the vendor was made whole. The vendor couldn't have a bad debt. The vendor's whole. It is Chrysler Financial and every other finance company that is in the business of buying debts, which could possibly have a bad debt. And the statute that we're discussing is a very clear statute. It has two parts, one of which describes the duties of the person who is making the sale. And this person who is making the sale, or the vendor, must perform certain duties in order to be eligible for this debt. The second part of the statute goes into what is a bad debt. Now, while the Board of Tax Appeals reached the first part of the statute and found that there was no standing, there are additional questions which we raise, and we say, take a good look at the kind of information submitted by the appellants as to what constitutes their bad debt. Look at the sheet of paper that they filed that says vendor's license, various. And then when they are asked to follow the and provide the burden of proof, which, as this court said in Key Services in 2002, must be extensive, they put Exhibit A, and they listed all of the criteria in the rule that's found in B of 57-03-944B. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and basically said, Department of Taxation, we have the records as you want it, come and get them. This is
Counselor,
going to...
Counselor.
Yes.
This whole situation has been remedied by subsequent changes in statute, correct? As far as the definition of who can take advantage of the write-off of bad debt associated with the sale, limiting the vendor, limiting the bad debt, correct?
Your Honor, this is correct. House Bill 95 did change the situation. When this bill was originally written, as you will notice in your statutory in the appendix of the appellee, we did put in a legislative discussion of what they intended, and I believe the people who wrote this bill intended fully that it would help the vendor. The guy who sells a refrigerator on installment, and then somewhere in the middle of the payments, the person with the refrigerator goes south to Mexico, taking the refrigerator and stops the
payments. So the purpose of the statute then is to refund tax that is in the coffers of the state that was inappropriately taken based on the history or the prospective activity of that account, correct?
Your Honor, that is correct, except let me just modify that slightly, remembering that there is an immunity to the state, and the General Assembly has allowed a small breach in that immunity for a refund for a specific kind of vendor, the individual who makes sales on installments, and who, because he's paying up front on the installments, is out some money. If the little guy with the refrigerator, and the refrigerator disappears out of state. Now, if you look at the qualifications, if the vendor is able to repossess the refrigerator, that is no longer considered a bad debt. If there is interest in that amount, it's no longer considered a bad debt. If there is a sale of the debt or the accounts receivable to another party, it's no longer considered a bad debt. And, Your Honors, that's what's happening here, and that's why there is all this material which my opponent says is excess. We wanted to point out that there is no statutory authority for a financing institution in the business of purchasing accounts receivable for the purposes of collecting a stream of income. And that's really all they purchase. If you look at the contract and read the contract, they get the rights to purchase that income.
Well, they claim there was an assignment.
That is correct. They are.
Do you think that there cannot be an assignment of this right to deduct the bad debt? Is that your view?
Your Honor, if you look on the contract, I looked very thoroughly. I did not see anything that said that there was a bad debt. Now, on page 147 of the supplement, appellant makes a very big statement that says the contract between the dealers and the vendors contains the assignment of the bad debt. However, appellant never submitted that into evidence. The only contract between the dealer and the vendor that we found is in the Indiana case, and we submitted that.
Well, Counselor, it wasn't a bad debt at the time the assignment occurred. It was shortly after the vehicle was sold to the consumer, and then the dealer turns over the paper, so to speak, to the Chrysler, correct? It's not a bad debt at that point.
Your Honor.
And then Is that correct?
Your Honor, Justice O'Connor, you are totally correct, because the vendor can never have a bad debt under the scenario posed by appellant.
Well, let me put it to you a different way. When Chrysler is assigned these accounts from their dealers, they're too new, too fresh, no history to indicate that they are not being paid. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, and the state of Ohio has already received their tax money for the full purchase price of the item at that point, correct?
That is correct.
So if the situation turns out as the Board of Tax Appeals has ruled or found, and if we affirm that, then the state of Ohio retains tax dollars on a vehicle that was not paid for by the consumer. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that is correct, but it is no longer the vendor, because the vendor has paid in full.
Well, let's get away from who pays it, the vendor or Chrysler. You know, we know that the state of Ohio has money in its coffers that, given if this paper was still in the name of the dealer, they would refund to the dealer, correct?
Your Honor, if the dealer had, if the vendor who was the person who made
the sale.
Let's
talk dealer and Chrysler instead of the word vendor right now.
Okay, if this dealer had the made an installment sale himself, yes, he would be eligible.
And what's the theory for allowing him to collect this paid upfront tax?
Well, he has a debt on his books. The debt has become worthless and uncollectible. Between the preceding return and the present return, that's according to the statute. And he has then filed, or he may file according to 26 U.S.C. 166, a bad debt. And he has the proof. And you know, Your Honor, under Ohio law, he only has to keep those records for 4 years. But if he has made a five-year installment sales, he has a reason to keep that record, because he wants to see if this sale is paid in full at the end of 5 years. However, when he transfers that account to Chrysler Financial for collection, he no longer has a rationale to keep those records. And Chrysler does not have the records that indicate tax was paid in full or any of the other requirements a vendor has. And further, there
does the tax department have the record that they received the tax on that transaction?
Your Honor, this is an administrative nightmare, because a vendor's license, we would have to do an extensive search to find the license and whether or not the license exists. And I understand that.
That's really not our concern.
I understand that. But there's also further question, Your Honor, of whether or not there was actually a bad debt as defined, because once you sell accounts receivable, that falls under the criteria of exclusion for bad debt under both the statute and the rule. There is no longer a bad debt. And once you're repossessing cars, there is no longer a bad debt. And the rationale is, how do you calculate exactly how much really was owed? If the interest was pre-computed, then
but
the
that can be done. The logistics of calculating the amount of the tax, the amount that is ultimately classified as a bad debt, excluding the interest and excluding any extraneous contracts or charges that are non-taxable items, that's a matter of bookkeeping.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, but it would be much easier and much more efficient, much better policy. As the Court of Maine pointed out recently in Daimler Chrysler case up in Maine, if that was the person who made the sale who kept those records. And don't forget, down the pike, we will have some in some finance companies which do not have vendor's licenses in this state, and they will also be
But they can't do that any longer because of the change in the statute. This is a window of opportunity that has been closed.
That's true, but there are 28 currently before the Board of Tax Appeals that were filed prior to the change in the statute. Those will go forward, and that will cost the state quite a bit of money, which under the rule, it should not, and under the law, it should not, just because of the definition of what is a bad debt. And I think that it is very clear, according to the statute, that they must meet all of the elements to have the refund, as well as an action for a refund of taxes is an action for money damages against the state, and it is only in specific statutes in which the General Assembly waived the state's immunity and consented to be sued for a refund. And in this instance, it is very clear that the state has stated that it would only be sued by for a refund by the vendor who made the sale, that is the person who made the sale in the transaction. That is the definition of a vendor. And it's important to remember, because my opponent here has talked about legislative intent and clarity of words. And it's very simple to look at the definition of vendor. And you see the word person. If you go back to the word person, you will see estate, you will see company, you will see natural person. And you then would substitute that word for person in the definition of vendor. You would not go directly from the definition of person into the alleged bad debt statute and substitute the word person for the word vendor. They are not exactly interchangeable. Vendor has a specific definition. The vendor is the person who has made the sale. Therefore, when it says in the statute that the vendor has the debt on his books and the debt's worthless and uncollectible between the preceding return and present return pursuant to the IRS, it is the person who has made the sale who has to have that particular debt on his books. Let me also remind this court that there is absolutely no evidence that appellant has met the burden of proof in any way possible in this case. There are no contracts between the vendor and the dealer in Ohio that were submitted into the record. And while the appellant makes general statements about how everything happens, this is only very general statements. And the Board of Tax Appeals, correct, did find that these general statements were sufficient to understand it, but we asked this court to take a good look at the evidence presented and to decide for itself. And further, there is a question, not only is this a bad debt, not only do they have the records required, the burden of proof required to prove that this is a bad debt, the narrow proof that this court said is necessary under Key Services to provide to the Department of Taxation before a refund can be given. But then we get into the question of, under today's law and today's manner of doing business, do they even own these debts at the time they become bad, or have they sold them someplace else for purposes of raising their own money? There are all sorts of questions that were not answered in this case, all sorts of evidence that was not brought forward about the situation of what exactly happened. The Department of Taxation found that there was no standing, and further, that there was no bad debt based on the sale of the assets to the financial company and based on the fact that there was repossession that occurred, both of which knocked this totally out.
You've used your time, Ms. Katz.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Otero, you've saved about 2.5 minutes of your time. Let me begin with a question to you. I'm I'm having difficulty in reading the statute, just applying the plain words of the statute here, the definition of vendor, to your argument that says we should read in really the principle of law that says an assignee succeeds to all the rights of the assignor. The statute, as you know, tax law is very, very statute-driven. And General Assembly says vendor means the person providing the service or by whom the transfer affected or license given by a sale is or to be made given. And then the definition of sale is the traditional definition of sale, where the transaction for consideration where title passes and personal property is transferred. I guess it seems to me the General Assembly did not, when it adopted this legislation, did not anticipate the situation we have here. And why should we go beyond the plain words of the statute and apply another principle of law in order to enable Chrysler to recover here?
Well, the statute itself doesn't say that you have to be the vendor that made the sale. As was correctly pointed out, the statute has subsequently been amended to try to say something similar to that. But the statute, the way that it's written right now, doesn't say that it says there has to have been a sale, but it doesn't say that the claimant has to have been the vendor that made the sale. That makes sense because somebody's got to be the claimant. There has to have been a bad debt, but it doesn't have to have been the person that sold it, because the person that sold it may not be the person that has the bad debt.
Chrysler and the dealer in a situation under the statute with which we're dealing, could it have, in its transaction, in the transfer of the paper to Chrysler, could it have provided a provision that would have said who gets the refund here under the statute, do you think, or would they have been forbidden under the statute to do that?
Well, it would be superfluous because in the contract, all rights are assigned. When you take all the rights of somebody, that would include any statutory rights that they would have.
Well, that's
for
the
example,
problem here, though. They're subject to statutory rights, and that's why this case is here, because there's some ambiguity in what the statute means, I guess, or how it should be applied.
Well,
so could there have been a specific and express provision in the assignment document that would cover this issue under the statute, do you think?
Well, there, as is pointed out before, there is no bad debt at the time of the assignment. You take as the BK
found.
Well,
but you know, a certain percentage of this paper, people that buy automobiles, default, and so Chrysler
right.
knows that a certain percentage of this paper they purchase, they're going to be people driving cars or whatever the thing is, they're going to default, and so they work. I assume that's all factored into their transactions.
But they took all the rights that are under that contract, and when I take all the rights that are under that contract, that includes statutory rights, and all those statutory rights are not spelled out. For example, it doesn't say in the contract that I take assignment of the ability to repossess the car and to foreclose my security interest. So if the contract had to say I get that statutory right, then Chrysler couldn't have foreclosed on any of these vehicles and couldn't have repossessed them. So there's when I take a full assignment of somebody's contractual rights, the statutory rights automatically follow. And under Ohio law, all contractual rights, statutory rights are freely assignable.
Mr. Otero, Ms. Katz has suggested that on repossession there is not a bad debt. Did you care to address that issue?
Yes. What the rule says and what the statute says is that a bad debt can't include repossessions. And, of course, that makes perfect sense because if I haven't deducted for the proceeds from my repossession, then I truly don't have a bad debt. In my example with the $20,000 car, if the customer paid $5,000 and I repossessed the car and I haven't sold it yet, and we don't really know what my bad debt is, I might get $15,000 and I might not have a bad debt. So rule and the statute provide that you got to deduct that.
Thank you, Mr. Otero. You've used your time.
Thank you.
case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Next case is 03-929, State of Ohio versus Kyle Martin. Abadala.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Saleh Awadallah. I'm an assistant Cuyahoga County prosecutor on behalf of the state of Ohio. At the outset, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. This matter is one concerning the Sixth Amendment constitutional right to counsel or to proceed without counsel. Specifically, the issue in this matter is whether, taken as a whole, the record in the state of Ohio versus Kyle Martin reflects that the defendant, in this case, proceeded with his eyes open. That is, did he know what was happening? Did he know that his rights to have his case litigated fully by counsel? And on the other hand, did he know that he had a right to proceed pro se without the absolute assistance of counsel? And the answer to those questions is yes, that the record does reflect that Mr. Martin's eyes were open. He had a full grasp of what was going on, and that the record also reflects him to be an articulate, sophisticated person with experience in criminal law, having 9 previous criminal convictions, having
counsel,
been sentenced.
Doesn't the record also reflect that he made it pretty clear that he wanted to co-counsel the case from?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, in that he did actually file a motion, a written motion for co-counsel. And I would argue that that is exactly what he received throughout his trial, is the ability to co-counsel. He took on some core functions of the trial, as well as having counsel take on core functions of an attorney during that trial. We had a voir dire process, which was largely conducted by counsel. Counsel argued a Rule 29 motion. Counsel was at Mr. Martin's side and at his beck and call throughout the trial. And I think the record reflects clearly that Mr. Martin realized this and took advantage of counsel and their abilities throughout the trial. The key here, I think, is the taking a pragmatic approach and taking the record as a whole. Does the record as a whole tell us that if Mr. Martin's eyes or the appellee's eyes were open in this case with regards to the waiver of whatever counsel he waived. In this matter, what the state would argue is that he received exactly what he asked for, which is hybrid representation. And the cases have said even in hybrid representation, we're still looking for some type of waiver because you are giving up some of your rights to have your trial conducted fully by experienced or by an attorney. And in this case, I think there is that waiver in that there are 5 motion hearings on the record that take up 112 pages of the transcript that the trial judge painstakingly went through with Mr. Martin as to what was going on, discussing motions with him, discussing co-counsel, motion of co-counsel. Mr. Martin, I understand my rights, that he wanted to participate actively. Page 21 and 22, I'm co-counsel. I should be able to file motions. Why should I have to wait on somebody when I could do it myself? He acknowledges that these are horrendous allegations. The judge in the July 5th, 2001 hearing tells him these are serious matters. You have serious charges, including conspiracy to commit aggravated murder, attempted murder, and kidnapping. Sounds like you want to be your own attorney. And the words he uses are very important, the judge, that is.
Well, but then, he did say that. Yes, he did. So it sounds like you want to be your own attorney, sir. Defendant, that's not what I'm asking the court. And then the court decided he was going to be his own attorney with the standby counsel. This is really a strange situation, isn't it?
But, Your Honor,
unusual, I guess.
Unusual, but yes. look at the defendant's conduct, not what he's saying, because it's his conduct that the trial judge is also looking at. Because the trial judge's words are, okay, I'll permit you to be your own counsel, because that's what he's asking. He wants to be counsel.
At what point, though, did he ask for new counsel? He just couldn't get along with the present counsel, and then he asked for new counsel.
The new counsel, well, he asked for new counsel repeatedly throughout, except at the very end when the jury was ready to be seated, he pops up and says, I want new counsel. That's not somebody who thinks that they're there on their own, that they have no help, when he's asking for new counsel as opposed to counsel, period. I will permit you to be your own counsel is responsive to Mr. Martin's conduct.
Well, but he
that
says
he wants
again,
to be his
that
own
same,
counsel.
And that same discourse between the court and the defendant, is it your intention, Mr. Martin, then to act as your own lawyer? Defendant, no, it is not. But that's my intention to participate as to doing all that I can to protect my rights as a citizen. And then it goes on, after that, the judge says you're going to be your own lawyer with this standby counsel. It sounds as if he maybe didn't trust lawyers. Totally. And so he wanted to have some role, some part in his defense in this criminal trial. Isn't that what he's currently thinking?
And it's important to note that that colloquy takes place July 9th at a motion hearing. The trial is not until July 30th. After that statement is made, I will permit you to be your own counsel, the judge goes back to him and says, listen, have you reconsidered? Here's what we can do. I can have counsel conduct a trial. You can ask questions. You can have the active participation that you want. Think about it. This takes
now,
place on.
Now, none of this was put in writing, was it?
Well, actually, he actually penned himself in his own words, in his own handwriting. A motion for co-counsel. It was put in writing by...
No, I mean the fact that he wanted to represent himself, that was never put in writing.
At that time, no, but he did...
But later it was?
No, before. That motion was submitted from the get-go.
Oh, okay.
I want to be co-counsel. I want to have active participation.
Oh, but he wanted to be co-counsel.
And that's what...
He never once said that he wanted to be his own attorney.
He did, because... When on the trial date, the judge asked him pointedly, how do you want to, okay, what's your pleasure? I've given you your right to be your own counsel. I've advised you against it. I've cautioned you against it. What do you want to do?
What did he say?
And he said that I am ready to proceed. He got up and he said, I am ready to proceed. And then he went into a whole litany about motions and dismissing the indictment, some type of pre-printed form. He got up and he said, I want to proceed.
And did he ever confer with these advisory attorneys?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the record is replete with instances in which both Mr. Standard from the Public Defender's Office and also Mr. Thompson from the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office, both capable attorneys, replete throughout the record of his turning to them and asking for advice. The judge even points it out, let the record reflect in a number of instances that the defendant is conferring with counsel. Counsel approaches sidebar with the appellee in this case.
Did they ever participate in asking questions and anything like that?
They participated in his direct testimony in his case. They participated in the voir dire. They, in fact, not just participated, basically conducted the voir dire, a very important part of a trial.
Did they give final arguments, opening statements?
Opening statements were made by Mr. Martin. Closing statements were made by Mr. Martin, again, at his request. Rule 29 motion was made by the attorney, I believe Mr. Thompson. There is a motion to dismiss a count that was prepared by the public defenders. It was signed by Mr. Martin, but it was a typed, well-reasoned motion that actually prompted the state then to dismiss one of the indictments. And that was prepared, the record will reflect, by the by co-counsel, by Mr. Standard and Mr. Thompson in this case.
Did the court provide any Faretta warnings?
I'm sorry?
Did the court provide any Faretta warning?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The court indicated to him that, you know, he cautioned him against abandoning his counsel. He told him it was not a good idea that what he was doing. He told him that these are very serious charges. And again, he kept coming back, five different motion hearings. At each one, he would say, you know, and the record clearly reflects this, are you going to reconsider your decision? And the ultimate answer to that was Mr. Martin standing up and saying, I am ready to proceed. And he did proceed, again, in arguing motion. So Faretta is clearly covered in these.
But counsel, there's no written waiver in the record, correct?
There is, I would argue that the co-counsel motion, which was written and signed by the defendant, is ample to cover that criminal rule 44C requirement.
And when was that executed, before or after the judge's admonitions and discussions with the defendant here?
That was before.
Okay, so wouldn't it make sense that once the judge cautions a defendant, whomever that is, about the pitfalls of self-representation, discharge of attorneys, et cetera, then the seriousness is, then the waiver should be signed or a document signed acknowledging the intelligent and comprehensive understanding of what the judge has gone over, not in a motion, you know, scratching the surface, so to speak.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think the issue here is, were his eyes open? And the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a very pragmatic position with regards to this issue. There is no standard, delineated, formalistic way to go about this. The trial judge has to satisfy himself that this defendant knows what he's doing and knows that he's given up, not that he's actually a good attorney or can present his case well, but knows that he has the right to have counsel present his case.
But there is a rule that says you have to inform the counsel, I mean the defendant, that if he wants to not have an attorney, that he has to be in writing. Isn't that true?
There is that rule, Your Honor.
He wanted both ways, didn't he? He wanted to represent himself, and he wanted an attorney.
Exactly.
Can he have both ways?
Well, he actually did get it both ways. Even though he didn't have a right under either the Ohio Constitution or the United States Constitution to have hybrid representation, he actually was allowed to have hybrid representation. And now he complains about the fact that he was allowed to have this hybrid
representation. Well, I think the problem with the case is that the judge didn't have him sign a waiver of counsel to begin with, to make sure the record was clear that he understood that he was going to represent himself and the pitfalls of representing himself.
Except, Your Honor, in that case, he had counsel. He had counsel. It wasn't a case where you have a Johnson case in the U.S. Supreme Court.
He also conducted his own questioning and running the trial.
He conducted portions of his trial. That is correct. But he had counsel. Criminal Rule 44C goes to complete waiver of counsel, I would argue. So not to just certain parts of counsel.
So you say that doesn't apply in this case?
I would argue it does not apply in this case. Other Ohio courts, lower districts, have argued substantial compliance with current Rule 44C as well. You had counsel. He had two attorneys sitting by him. This is not a case where, as in Johnson, where an indictment happens on January 21st, a trial on January 23rd, and the person is sentenced on January 25th without any assistance of counsel. He had five lengthy motion hearings. And if we're talking written waiver as being sufficient, you go to Von Moltke. There was a written waiver in that case. That was a plea. The housewife who had never been in trouble before actually signed a written waiver. That wasn't sufficient. And I don't think we want to go down that road where we have a formalistic, you know, here's five things on this sheet of paper, sign it, and put it in a file. You have not waived your right to counsel. I think it's more important than just
isn't it required to have both inquiry by the court, satisfaction by the court, and then the allowance of the defendant to execute the written document as testimony to his understanding? One without the other is insufficient.
And that might be the case where you don't have the two attorneys sitting next to you. When you don't have a hybrid representation, I would argue, and the way the U.S. Supreme Court has taken it, where you have we have counsel being waived on a post-indictment statement, saying Miranda rights are okay to waive counsel in those cases, and I would argue that there is a method and a line that where it progressively it gets more rigid and more rigorous. And I would argue that would be when you have no counsel at your side. And I would argue that the hybrid representation falls way short of that. That there is an opportunity, such as in this case, where you have two counsel that you've conferred with who have actively participated in your trial. How can you now come before the courts and say, I wasn't aware that I had a right to counsel? Well, I mean, you had them.
You've used your time, Mr. O'Dowd.
I'm sorry?
You've used your time.
Oh,
your red light is on. That's what that means.
I apologize.
Ms. Roby.
Good morning. Mr. Martin was denied the assistance of counsel at trial. He proceeded through trial without the effective assistance of counsel as is required by the Sixth Amendment, and he did not waive his right to counsel.
Counsel. We know that he did not sign a written waiver, but the prosecution argues that he did have assistance of counsel. You say he did not have the assistance of effective counsel. So is this case really a case about ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well,
or is it a case about no counsel? Because, I mean, some of the language of the court seems to be saying to him, well, you don't want a lawyer, I guess. But the prosecution argues that isn't the way it ended up. So is this a case about ineffective assistance of counsel, or is it a case about waiver?
Well, this is a case about the denial of the right to counsel. And the right to counsel is the effective assistance of counsel. And my point is that by providing standby counsel, you do not satisfy the constitutional right to counsel. That does not suffice. You cannot provide someone with a standby attorney in place.
What does that term mean as you use it? And what did it mean in terms of this trial? I mean, the word standby could imply that the lawyers are on deck, in the back of the room, in the hallway. But if they're setting a counsel table and participating along with their client, that might not seem to be like an appropriate use of the term.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, they were sitting next to the defendant, but the court was, in fact, restricting their participation. When they jumped in to help him finish voir dire, Mr. Martin did start the voir dire on his own and was completely unable to do it, of course. The court then advised him, I'm going to allow you to have your attorneys ask the jury some questions for voir dire, but I'm not going to let them do this throughout trial. Later, and then Mr. Martin, after the voir dire, Mr. Martin questioned every witness on his own, did the trial on his own, The Rule 29, again, his lawyers were permitted to argue because, of course, Mr. Martin wouldn't know what a Rule 29 motion was. And then when Mr. Martin was on the stand, the court again granted permission to allow his counsel to participate. So in this case, it's not even what some courts have recognized as a hybrid, because Mr. Martin did not have the option of enlisting his counsel's help when he needed it. Now, if I can address this motion
for... Before you leave that, what do you mean by that?
What do I mean by...
That he did not have the right to use his counsel.
When he needed it, you said.
Well,
I had the same question, exactly.
The court told him, I'm going to allow your counsel to participate at this point, but not throughout the trial. The court had told Mr. Martin, you are going to represent yourself. I know you say you don't want to do it, but I know that's what you really mean. You really do mean you want to represent yourself, and you're going to.
But did the court prevent counsel, the so-called standby counsel, from negotiating with Mr. Martin how the standby counsel would help him? The court didn't put any restrictions on standby counsel, did it?
Well, the court informed Mr. Martin that he would not be permitted to use his counsel throughout the trial. And I think that we can reasonably infer that restricted him.
What did that mean? We don't know what that means, I guess.
Do we?
Practically, we don't know what that means.
But I think we do, because the judge did not allow counsel to question witnesses, and he didn't let him have it both ways, so to speak. He said, you want to represent yourself, and so you're not going to have these attorneys asking questions. You can't have it both ways. And looking at Rule 44, it says, after being fully advised of his right to assign counsel, knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waives his right to counsel. I don't think there was a meeting of the minds of the defendant and the judge.
There certainly wasn't, Your Honor. In this case, Mr. Martin told the judge about a dozen times, I do not want to represent myself. I do not want to go pro se. I need an attorney.
And
I
then
want
on
an
top
attorney.
Of it, we don't have any in serious offenses. We're supposed to have a written waiver.
Correct.
And we
there's
don't
no,
have that.
There's no written waiver. There were no Faretta warnings. Even the written motion for co-counsel that the state has referred to as being, as requesting self-representation, the text of that notice of respective defense, as it was titled, was, now comes the defendant, Kyle Martin, who gives the court notice there will be a respective relationship between defense counsel and defendant in the defense case. Mr. Martin never said, I want to question witnesses. Mr. Martin never said, I want to be permitted to do openings and closings at my trial. I believe that Mr. Martin, although it was not fully fleshed out by any questions by the court, I believe that Mr. Martin just wanted to be permitted to file these pro se motions that he had been filing. And it's not unusual, and for some reason, this notice of respective defense seems to rub the judge the wrong way.
Counsel, from where we're sitting, it sounds an awful like to properly decide this case, we're going to have to crawl through the whole record because there seems to be a dispute, almost an evidentiary dispute, about exactly what role did counsel play from start to finish, at various motions and throughout the trial. It doesn't sound like the two of you are in agreement as to what actually took place, or what the meaning, certainly not what the import was of what took place. So let me take you back to the Court of Appeals. It strikes me that the Court of Appeals really ended up deciding this on some comments of the trial judge and the absence of a written waiver. Is that that turned the whole case for them, or am I mistaken about what turned the case for them?
The Court of Appeals took a look at the hearing in which the judge told the defendant he was representing himself. In that hearing, the court did nothing in the way of approximating a Feretta instruction, did not do a penetrating and comprehensive examination as von Moltke requires. And von Moltke is pretty explicit.
But that was one hearing of many, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they seized on what the judge said in that hearing and then and said, well, the judge is telling him he's on his own and there's no written waiver. Isn't that how they decided this case?
There was not any sort of Feretta warning given in other hearings either, Your Honor. In the first hearing, in the context of a speedy trial waiver that the defendant did not want to execute, the judge said, this is a serious case. You're facing serious charges. And at that, and that was in the context of, you know, sir, you may want to consider giving your attorney more time to prepare this case. This had nothing to do with right to counsel. This was a very brief discussion, very surface, touching on the fact that this was a serious case. It was on July 20th, 10 days before trial, that the judge said, you are going to represent yourself. There were no actions by Mr. Martin which should have led to an implied waiver of counsel, and there were no actions by Mr. Martin which could be construed as a voluntary waiver of counsel. Because at
counsel,
that hearing,
what situation, you know, the judge finds himself with a defendant and a team of attorneys, and the defendant wants a hybrid type of relationship here. Now, you're saying that he only wanted to be able to file his own motions. Do you mean in addition to motions that his team of attorneys would have prepared?
Well, that's what was going on. And that's my understanding of this, because he never said he wanted to stand up at trial and conduct parts
of the
trial.
Okay, all right. What happens, though, when we have a defendant who wants to participate by questioning and would insist on questioning defendants, but also wanted to do that selectively? You would agree that's permissible?
Well, Your Honor, the defendant does not have a constitutional right to a hybrid form of representation, but a court can allow it. It would certainly be permissible if a defendant clearly stated his desire to actively conduct parts of his trial, then the judge would be required to get a waiver of counsel in writing after going through the Feretta inquiry, because you need to waive your right to counsel in order to engage in this hybrid.
But not a standard waiver of counsel. We're talking about several different things here. A selective waiver of counsel as opposed to a total waiver of a counsel as opposed to acceptance of counsel in a standby capacity?
Your Honor, I believe that a waiver of your right to counsel, a full, valid, complete waiver, is required before allowing a defendant to engage in hybrid representation. The courts of Ohio have not, to my knowledge, addressed this issue. The Sixth Circuit has in Wilson versus Hurt, and their logic simply was that because you cannot force a defendant to take on certain core parts of his trial, for instance, if a defense attorney shows up and says, okay, I'm pretty much ready, but you're going to do the opening, this is not effective assistance of counsel, and the defendant's rights to counsel would be violated. Because you cannot put that on the defendant, in order to allow a defendant to have a hybrid form of representation at trial, you would need to get a valid waiver of counsel. And this means all of the warnings of the dangers and the von Moltke list of considerations that the trial court has a duty to discuss with the defendant, and then a written waiver per 44C.
I wanted to follow up on that question, because one of the reasons I voted to allow this case review in the merits is because I thought it might give us an opportunity to write on the hybrid representation, which we haven't done. As you indicated, the circuits, our federal circuits, seem to be somewhat split. Sixth Circuit, we do have the Wilson opinion. Do you think this case offers us the opportunity to write, to set a standard for hybrid representation, or is this, if it isn't, it seems to me we're dealing with error correction.
Well, what occurred at trial here was quite similar, if not actually a form of hybrid representation. And the fact that that Mr. Martin proceeded through trial with this hybrid representation, despite the fact that he did not waive his right to counsel, is a violation.
In the cases that have set a standard for hybrid representation, is there an express waiver of counsel and all? Is that one of the requirements as you read them? In Wilson, was there a waiver?
In Wilson, the court did review, the court did say absolutely you need a waiver of counsel before you can engage in hybrid representation. And in Wilson, the court did something of a survey of other circuits. And in fact, the circuits were pretty much in agreement with Wilson that you have to have a full waiver of counsel. However, they noted there were a few opinions that indicated that some slim forms of hybrid representation could take place without a full waiver, and those were merely allowing the defendant to, for instance, testify over the objections of his counsel, or allowing the defendant to ask a few questions
after
his counsel.
Very limited participation by the defendant.
Exactly. Just a little bit of participation may be permitted without a full waiver. And in my experience, it's my understanding that my client has the right to override my recommendations in any case. So I did not see a problem with not needing a waiver of counsel in order to, for instance, have my client say, I'm going to testify over your advice. In this case, Mr. Martin did not get what he asked for. He asked to have some control, and he wanted some input into how his defense was going to be conducted. He never said he wanted to conduct his trial. He never said he wished to waive his right to counsel. In fact, he clearly invoked his right to counsel, yet was forced to proceed without the effective assistance of counsel at trial. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Roby. Mr. Abdallah, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize for running over my time. The Wilson v. Hurt is exactly what happened in this instance, and I think it is a good opportunity to address the hybrid representation issue, because it happens frequently, and frequently the trial judge is left in a quandary what to do in this type of situation. And and they did say that there should be Feretta warnings, but those warnings are no formality required, searching inquiry into defendant's knowledge, and so there's no really formality with regards to the Feretta rights.
How much, if we were writing a rule of law on this standard, how much discretion should be given to the defendant or how much responsibility, I guess it would be, should we expect the defendant to have in deciding whether he or she wants hybrid representation if it's explained to them? Is that a decision that would be ultimately made by the trial court, or can the defendant, after being given all the proper instructions, do that himself or herself, in your view?
Well, I think, I mean, the problem is with the full waiver of counsel is it's not a full waiver of counsel. So I think, to answer your question, I think you do leave it up to the defendant to decide what the relationship is going to be. But to have him then execute a written waiver of entire counsel just flies in the face of what's going on.
Well, Ms. Roby says that I haven't had a chance yet to read the circuit cases, which we'll do, but she says that the cases say that there has to be a waiver first, and then the court, I guess, somehow creates this hybrid representation.
Well, that's correct, but the waiver that the Wilson court talks about is what happened in this case.
It's a different form of waiver.
Yeah, you just tried to dissuade him from doing that. You tell him it's a very important case, these are learned counsel, that type of waiver, making sure that he understands he doesn't have to do this, that he doesn't have to
do opening statements, or he doesn't have to.
But there wasn't really any waiver here, was there? Because he said he wasn't waiving.
He did. When he said, I wish to proceed, he meant, I wish to proceed. I wish to go on and present his case. I mean, it's his words. Now, the words of the trial court happened three motion hearings before that. He says, I wish to proceed. And when he does that, he means, I wish to proceed and take active participation and conduct a trial as he conducted them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Next case is State of Ohio versus Terry White, 03-1048-1049. Mr. Hardwick.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. The General Assembly has recognized that it just isn't cost-effective to try to get blood from a turnip. And that's one of the reasons why Section 2949.14 makes sense, because it only authorizes the recovery of court costs from non-indigent defendants and defendants who are non-indigent at the time of conviction. When read in peri materia with Section 2947.23, a trial court can only impose costs on defendants who are indigent at the time of conviction. Now, these two statutes should be read together because they both concern the same subject matter, which is the recovery of costs from indigent defendants.
The Court of Appeals seems to suggest that the statute with respect to the clerk's ability to collect would not bar the clerk from collecting from one who was indigent and then no longer was indigent, had assets.
Well, yes, they said that, but that holding ignores the language of 2949.14 that freezes in time the indigency status at the time of conviction and ignores the six words at the beginning of that statute, which are upon the conviction of a non-indigent defendant. Now, it is not patently unreasonable to separate the two statutes, but even if you separate the two statutes, Mr. White still wins because he was indigent at the time of conviction. So even if the Court of Appeals correctly separated him, Mr. White still wins because in the sentencing entry, the court found that he had been found to be indigent. And 3 days later, he filed an affidavit of indigency that showed zero assets and zero income. Now, it's hard to get more indigent than zero assets and zero income, and his indigency has never been contested by the state in this litigation. For the state to win in this case, there has to be a violation of four rules of statutory construction. As I first discussed, the doctrine of imperi materia applies because these statutes concern the same subject. As I've also just discussed, the courts have to give meaning to all words in a statute, and the state and the Court of Appeals opinion does not give meaning to the words upon the conviction of a non-indigent person. Also, it would violate the doctrine, and I'm not going to use the Latin here because I'm afraid I'd mispronounce it, that the inclusion of one thing excludes all others. And here there's a statute that expressly states gives a way to collect court costs, a way to impose and collect court costs from non-indigent defendants. There is no parallel statute for how to collect them from indigent defendants. And this court should give meaning to the legislature's decision to only provide a means of certification and collection from non-indigent defendants. And finally, as the Court of Appeals has noted, the specific controls over the general. We have a general statute in Section 2947.23 which involves the imposition of court costs generally, but we have a very specific provision about what to do, how to deal with someone's indigency status or lack thereof, and that's 2949.14. And the specific provisions of 2949.14 should be given preference over the more general rules of 2947.23. The legislature's distinction makes sense for a number of reasons that I haven't gotten to yet. There's only so much burden that the courts and the justice system can place on indigent defendants. We want these folks to become productive members of society again. If we start adding court costs to fines, to probation fees to sex offender registration fees. It makes it very difficult for someone to go out and live an honest living and to get and to integrate themselves into society. So it makes sense that the legislature says, okay, you can't afford to pay, you're indigent, you do your time, you serve your probation, then you go back and become a member of society. Also, making the indigency determination as 29.
So that's an interesting little argument. You don't have opposing counsel, so amuse us a little. Are you suggesting that it encourages people to go out and not make an honest living in order to pay their court costs?
It makes it one more burden, one more way that they can be violated for their community control, violated for their post-release control. A standard term of community control and post-release control in the state is the payment of court costs.
Okay. You really think people are going to go out and steal just so they can pay their court costs? That seems improbable to me.
Not that they would steal, it's not necessarily that they would steal to pay their court costs, but it would be one more way that they could be violated and sent back, one more way that makes it harder for them to stay on the outside.
Couldn't it be looked at as an incentive to get a job so you could pay your court costs and then have some closure to your criminal activity?
Yeah, that is one way to look at it, Your Honor. Again, I'm trying to find a reason why would the trying to give some rational basis to show that the legislature, why they would not put this burden on indigent defendants, why they would place it only on non-indigent defendants. And because we could expect the Martha Stewarts of the world to pay your court costs. We shouldn't expect someone who has zero income, zero liabilities to pay their court costs. That's just not realistic. And if perhaps possibly even more, I think, a more compelling policy rule to look at the indigency only at the time of conviction is that this is a time when everyone is looking at the defendant's financial situation. It promotes finality, and it promotes accuracy. Defendant already has appointed counsel. We're looking at the financial situation for whether they can be appointed counsel, whether they can pay the fines, whether they can pay the mandatory fine. Mr. White's case, the reason he filed the indigency affidavit right about the time of sentencing is for the waiver of the mandatory fine.
At the time that indigency is determined, is there an assessment of possible future assets that may come to the indigent defendant? He may be indigent today, but there may be an estate. He may be the beneficiary of an estate or whatever. Is that?
Well, if he actually had the asset at the time, then that should go on the affidavit of indigency. And if he lies on his affidavit of indigency, then he can be punished for perjury.
A future interest is not determined.
Correct. Future interest. Unless that future interest is somehow already vested. If they have a rich uncle who hasn't died yet and they're in the will, well, that's not good enough. If they have some sort of springing property interest in something, well, that should be on their affidavit of indigency.
What about community service? Can that be considered at time of sentencing when they're indigent?
I don't think I understand.
2947.23 talks about indigents doing community service in lieu of payment of costs.
Well, that, I guess
you're familiar with that.
That could be a consideration, although Mr. White was sent to prison for 7 months. Mm-hmm. There may be some constitutional problems with.
That's what I was getting at.
Forcing someone.
See something wrong with that?
Yeah,
although it's in the statute that they can do that.
Counsel, again, we're handicapped by your opposition not being here and there not being many facts that we have. What's going on in the real world on a daily basis on these matters? Are costs being assessed against indigents? I mean, you point out the first part of the statute is pretty specific in terms of what it tells the clerk they may collect. The other statute allows the judge to assess it, right?
That on its face, when read by itself, yes.
All right. And you're asking us to hold the judge can't even assess it, rather than. I mean, you could get the same practical result by saying the clerk doesn't have any authority to collect it.
In theory, Your Honor, that is correct. part of the problem that the criminal defendants have faced is that when they come back and try to challenge collection, it's happened in the second and the and also the 10th district, and the cases are cited in my brief, that they're told, well, the res judicata bars you from attacking it. Now, I don't think that's a proper bar. I think those decisions are incorrect, but they have a difficulty in challenging that at a later basis. It makes much more sense to do it all at once. And
So clerks are trying, in your view, illegally to collect.
Correct.
Something that they don't have statutory authority to collect.
Correct, Your Honor. And it also varies from district to district. In most courts now, in the 4th district where Clark came out of, court costs aren't even being imposed. I do know what I've heard of one county common police court judge who decided in the 4th district who says under the new reporting rules there's no such thing as a binding opinion, therefore I'm going to keep imposing them anyway. But for the most part in the 4th they've stopped. I've had letters from clerk's offices about $49 court cost bills
trying to collect. That earlier statement. We have a trial judge who says under our new reporting rules, he's no longer bound by any appellate decision of his appellate district.
Right, that distinction, that binding versus non-binding, that the new rules say that all opinions shall be given towards the effect of whatever someone thinks they should be given. His opinion is that the new reporting rules make them non-binding. If you don't like it, you can appeal. And what I'm saying also goes to show what I just talked about, the finality, what everyone's looking at in the res judicata question also goes towards showing why we should look at only an indigency at the time of conviction, because if a defendant is wrongly assessed court costs at the time of conviction and was in fact indigent, he or she has the right to appeal. They have appointed counsel, just like Mr. White did. They can appeal and resolve the issue once and for all, whereas if under the Court of Appeals ruling, this is an issue that remains open for years, subject to litigation for years on end, and it can be brought up over and over again, and it becomes inefficient. And if we force people to litigate the indigency status as they go along, that actually opens the door for lots of litigation. That means that every inmate in prison now is no longer bound by res judicata and can challenge the collection of court costs, arguing that they're currently indigent. It also creates a nice bright line rule that's easy for everyone to follow. You look at it, is indigent or not, then we move on. We don't waste taxpayer, most of these cases, collection and defense are all done at taxpayer expense. This avoids the taxpayer spending the equivalent of sending out a 37-cent stamp to collect a 25-cent bill. On the certified question, and there's one important point on the certified question that wasn't addressed by the Court of Appeals because it wasn't at issue in this case, but since this case can't affect other cases, and this court is making rules that could affect other cases, the certified question asks, may a court impose costs on an indigent defendant? We respectfully say the answer is no. If this court disagrees and says yes, ask that this court scrupulously stick to the word may, because there is a dispute between the second and the third district right now about whether a trial court has the right to waive the imposition of court costs. Section 2949.092 says that certain court costs can be waived only if all court costs can be waived. The second district has said that this means that a trial court has the discretion to waive court costs. That issue has to be raised by the trial attorney in the trial court.
Counselor, is there a uniform definition of indigency in all 88 counties that they are using for example, their eligibility for a public defender? How is that?
Well, I know for public defense, for what they're eligible for appointment of counsel, that's in the Ohio Administrative Code in Section 120. I can't give you the exact cite off the top of my head, but it's in Section 120, which is the public defender statute. I believe it's 125% of the poverty level.
Okay, so that is the baseline or the maximum, I would imagine, of income that you're allowed to have to be able to access a public defender.
That's, I believe, that's a presumptive level. If you go above that, a certain amount above that, it becomes less clear, it becomes more arguable. You can argue that you're entitled to it.
But then there is the declaration of assets that have to be done, because we're talking about income there. When the judge makes the inquiry for the purposes of the imposition of costs or fines.
Correct.
And that, I mean, it, just because they have a public defender doesn't mean that they meet the criteria then for the indigency status for the purposes of costs.
Right, Your Honor, although fortunately, that is possibly correct, but fortunately in this case we have facts that make it easier to make the decision because we have 3 days after sentencing an indigency affidavit which is uncontested, which says zero income, zero assets. And that when you get zero, it makes it a nice, easy case for an appellate court to review and make law. And can leave for another day if this court wants to, what exactly is indigency for the purposes of paying court costs. Your Honor, in the absence of any other questions, the General Assembly made a rational policy decision only to authorize the collection of court costs for non-indigent defendants, and therefore, by implication, to exclude the recovery of court costs from indigent defendants. I ask this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Hardwick. The appellee has waived oral argument. I have not filed a brief. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn the court. Thank you.